This is tape one, side one.
The secret of divine civilization. Introduction. Never has the spiritual character of true civilization been revealed under such extraordinary circumstances by an author so qualified as in this text by Abdu'l-Bahá. Written in the year 1875, the original Persian text was lithographed in Bombay in 1882. The first English translation was published in London 1910 and later in Chicago 1918 under the title Mysterious Forces of Civilization. The present translation by Marzia Gale, a more accurate rendering, reflects the mastery of both languages possessed by an accomplished author whose father was Persian and whose mother was American, and who has lived for years in both countries. The name Abdu'l-Bahá has attained unique fame throughout the East and the West, a symbol of wisdom, nobility, heroism, and complete consecration to the cause of spiritual unity and universal peace. His name is a title meaning Servant of Bahá, Servant of Bahá'u'lláh. Born in Persia on May 23, 1844, eldest son of Bahá'u'lláh, Abdu'l-Bahá saw the light on the very day that Ali Muhammad, now known as the Bab, announced his mission of inaugurating a new religious dispensation and preparing the way for Bahá'u'lláh, author of the Bahá'í Revelation. Abdu'l-Bahá was but 6 years old when the Bab was martyred in Tabriz, 8 years of age when Bahá'u'lláh was imprisoned in a dungeon in Tehran by order of the Shah, and a few months later accompanied Bahá'u'lláh on his exile to Baghdad. This commenced a period of exile and imprisonment endured by Abdu'l-Bahá until the year 1908. From Baghdad, Bahá'u'lláh, his family, and attendants were conducted to Constantinople, from Constantinople to Adrianople, and from Adrianople to the fortress prison in Akka in the Holy Land, where Bahá'u'lláh ascended in 1892. Throughout this period, Abdu'l-Bahá, steeled in adversity, triumphant in spirit, increasingly manifested those qualities and powers upon which Bahá'u'lláh established the future of his world faith by appointing Abdu'l-Bahá, in his will and testament, the exemplar of the religious life, the interpreter of his word, and the center of his covenant with mankind. From 1892 until 1908, Abdu'l-Bahá suffered extreme oppression. Freed at last by the revolution in Turkey, which released all political prisoners sentenced by the Sultan, it was General Allenby, military conqueror of Palestine in the First World War, who, under instructions from Lord Balfour, British Foreign Secretary, took measures to assure his protection. From 1911 to 1913, Abdu'l-Bahá journeyed through Europe and North America, visiting the local Baha'i communities, addressing public audiences in peace societies, universities, churches, Negro conferences, and synagogues, meeting distinguished personages in government, clerical, and educational life, and promulgating by example and eloquent speech the principles of universal peace. The roster of these distinguished persons is too extensive to include here, but the character of Abdu'l-Bahá's reception in the West may be indicated by naming, among many others, Archdeacon Wilberforce, Reverend R. J. Campbell, Lord Lamington, Sir Michael Sadler, the Maharajas of Jalawar and Rajputana, Professor E. G. Brown, and Professor Patrick Geddes in London, the Persian minister, the Turkish ambassador, church dignitaries of various branches of the Christian tree in Paris, Professor Arminius Bambury, several members of parliament, Count Albert Apponyi, Prelate Alexander Gieswin, and Professor Ignatius Goldziher in Vienna, and in America, Dr. David Starr Jordan, Rabbi Stephen Weiss, Alexander Graham Bell, Honorable Franklin K. Lane, Mrs. William Jennings Bryan, Andrew Carnegie, Honorable Franklin McVeigh, Admiral Perry, Rabindranath Tagore. The recorded talks and the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, which seem to preserve the essence of his message to the West, include the addresses delivered in City Temple, London, at Stanford University, California, in Temple Emmanuel, San Francisco, his letter addressed to the Committee on Durable Peace, The Hague, and his letter addressed to the late Dr. Farrell, scientist of Switzerland. In many public talks in the United States, he called upon America to lead the nations to peace, justice, and social order. In some answered questions, Laura Barney accurately recorded Abdu'l-Bahá's answers to questions related to the Prophet, to man's destiny, his attributes and powers, to immortality and the life hereafter, which have long been cherished as an ideal introduction to this new age of universal religion. The mission so faithfully fulfilled by Abdu'l-Bahá from 1892 to 1921 as head of the Baha'i World Community, providential as it was, does not directly concern the text presented in this volume. The secret of divine civilization consists of a message addressed to the rulers of the people of Persia, whose once glorious civilization had been reduced to pitiful weakness by the corruption of its government, the ignorance of its masses, and the abandonment of the essential truths of its religion. Severed from personal consideration of the cruel hardships imposed upon him by his native land, Abdu'l-Bahá in this work offered Persia the rich treasure of his illumined understanding of the causes of the fall and rise of civilization, a clear guide to the path of future greatness and the pattern of a true social order. Ignored, though this rare offering has been by those for whose welfare it was intended, Abdu'l-Bahá's message applies to the general state of modern civilization as a whole, whose traditional imperialism, nationalism, racialism, materialism, and sectarianism have brought mankind to the verge of the supreme disaster foretold by prophetic passages in the sacred writings of all extant religions. The secret of divine civilization is therefore submitted to the student of society as a treatise which fills the wide gap separating technical politics and technical economics from the very purpose of man's creation, the establishment of righteousness on earth. The reader has but to turn to this oft-quoted passage to appreciate how Abdu'l-Bahá transmutes spiritual truth into social terms. True civilization will unfurl its banner in the midmost heart of the world whenever a certain number of its distinguished and high-minded sovereigns, the shining exemplars of devotion and determination, shall, for the good and happiness of all mankind, arise with firm resolve and clear vision to establish the cause of universal peace. They must make the cause of peace the object of general consultation and seek by every means in their power to establish a union of the nations of the world. They must conclude a binding treaty and establish a covenant, the provisions of which shall be sacred, inviolable, and definite. They must proclaim it to all the world and obtain for it the sanction of all the human race. This supreme and noble undertaking, the real source of the peace and well-being of all the world, should be regarded as sacred by all that dwell on earth. All the forces of humanity must be mobilized to ensure the stability and permanence of this most great covenant. The fundamental principle underlying this solemn fact should be so fixed that if any government later violate any one of its provisions, all the governments on earth should arise to reduce it to utter submission. Nay, the human race as a whole should resolve with every power at its disposal to destroy that government. Should this greatest of all remedies be applied to the sick body of the world, it will assuredly recover from its ills and will remain eternally safe and secure. To Abdu'l-Bahá, civilization is an organism sustained by an all-permeating and guiding spirit, an organism in which the units can never be equal, but every unit has its function to render to the whole body. Equalitarianism is the false interpretation of justice. Only in unity can men find fulfillment, for unity is one spirit animating the diversity of men. This all-permeating spirit cannot be generated by external pressures, nor will it bring victory to any partisan or sectarian aim. It has manifested itself in history through the spirit of faith inspired by the prophets and their early followers who sacrificed personal desires for love of God. This spirit is the expression of God's love for humanity, and its light has so far been eclipsed by the lesser, divisive, and temporary loyalties which have claimed the hearts of men. Because Abdu'l-Bahá lived within this universal spirit, because Abdu'l-Bahá unified and reconciled within himself the diverse powers which men express through the sciences, the arts, the philosophies, the trades, the professions, and political administration, he could conceive of the divine element in civilization and become the first citizen in the commonwealth of man. In his conception, we discover this commonwealth each for himself and each for his fellow men. Abdu'l-Bahá has brought the sublime truth revealed by the prophets into the life of our day. The Western reader will not fail to note that Abdu'l-Bahá employed passages from the Quran on which to establish the spiritual significances of his theme and to press his appeal to the Islamic nation of Persia. Since the Quran is little known in the West, these passages have an incidental importance in making the Western reader more familiar with the holy book of the Arabic and Persian peoples, at a time when understanding of the Orient is direly needed in Europe and America. This introduction was written by Horace Holley, July 4, 1956. In the name of God, the Clement, the Merciful. Praise and thanksgiving be unto Providence, that out of all the realities in existence, he has chosen the reality of man and has honored it with intellect and wisdom, the two most luminous lights in either world. Through the agency of this great endowment, he has in every epoch cast on the mirror of creation new and wonderful configurations. If we look objectively upon the world of being, it will become apparent that from age to age, the temple of existence has continually been embellished with a fresh grace and distinguished with an ever-varying splendor, deriving from wisdom and the power of thought. This supreme emblem of God stands first in the order of creation and first in rank, taking precedence over all created things. Witness to it is the holy tradition. Before all else, God created the mind. From the dawn of creation, it was made to be revealed in the temple of man. Sanctified is the Lord, who with the dazzling rays of this strange heavenly power has made our world of darkness the envy of the world of light. And the earth shall shine with the light of her Lord. Holy and exalted is he who has caused the nature of man to be the dayspring of this boundless grace. The God of mercy hath taught the Quran, hath created man, hath taught him articulate speech. O ye that have minds to know, raise up your suppliant hands to the heaven of the one God, and humble yourselves and be lowly before him, and thank him for this supreme endowment, and implore him to succor us until, in this present age, godlike impulses may radiate from the conscience of mankind, and this divinely kindled fire, which has been entrusted to the human heart, may never die away. Consider carefully all these highly varied phenomena, these concepts, this knowledge, these technical procedures and philosophical systems, these sciences, arts, industries, and inventions. All are emanations of the human mind. Whatever people has ventured deeper into this shoreless sea has come to excel the rest. The happiness and pride of a nation consists in this, that it should shine out like the sun in the high heaven of knowledge. Shall they who have knowledge and they who have it not be treated alike? And the honor and distinction of the individual consists in this, that he among all the world's multitudes should become a source of social good. Is any larger bounty conceivable than this, that an individual looking within himself should find that by the confirming grace of God, he has become the cause of peace and well-being, of happiness and advantage to his fellow men? No, by the one true God, there is no greater bliss, no more complete delight. How long shall we drift on the wings of passion and vain desire? How long shall we spend our days like barbarians in the depths of ignorance and abomination? God has given us eyes that we may look about us at the world and lay hold of whatsoever will further civilization and the arts of living. He has given us ears that we may hear and profit by the wisdom of scholars and philosophers and arise to promote and practice it. Senses and faculties have been bestowed upon us to be devoted to the service of the general good, so that we, distinguished above all other forms of life for perceptiveness and reason, should labor at all times and along all lines, whether the occasion be great or small, ordinary or extraordinary, until all mankind are safely gathered into the impregnable stronghold of knowledge. We should continually be establishing new bases for human happiness and creating and promoting new instrumentalities toward this end. How excellent, how honorable is man if he arises to fulfill his responsibilities! How wretched and contemptible if he shuts his eyes to the welfare of society and wastes his precious life in pursuing his own selfish interests and personal advantages! Supreme happiness is man, and he beholds the signs of God in the world and in the human soul if he urges on the steed of high endeavor in the arena of civilization and justice. We will surely show them our signs in the world and within themselves. And this is man's uttermost wretchedness, that he should live inert, apathetic, dull, involved only with his own base appetite. When he is thus, he has his being in the deepest ignorance and savagery, thinking lower than the brute beasts. They are like the brutes, yea, they go more astray, for the vilest beasts in God's sight are the deaf, the dumb, who understand not. We must now highly resolve to arise and lay hold of all those instrumentalities that promote the peace and well-being and happiness, the knowledge, culture, and industry, the dignity, value, and station of the entire human race. Thus, through the restoring waters of pure intention and unselfish effort, the earth of human potentialities will blossom with its own latent excellence and flower into praiseworthy qualities, and bear and flourish until it comes to rival that rose garden of knowledge which belonged to our forefathers. Then will this holy land of Persia become in every sense the focal center of human perfection, reflecting, as if in a mirror, the full panoply of world civilization. All praise and honor be to the day spring of divine wisdom, the dawning point of revelation, that is Muhammad, and to the holy line of his descendants, since by the widespread rays of his consummate wisdom, his universal knowledge, those savage denizens of Yathrib, Medina, and Batha, Mecca, miraculously and in so brief a time, were drawn out of the depths of their ignorance, rose up to the pinnacles of learning, and became centers of arts and sciences and human perfections, and stars of felicity and true civilization, shining across the horizons of the world. His Majesty the Shah has, at the present time, 1875, resolved to bring about the advancement of the Persian people, their welfare and security, and the prosperity of their country. He has spontaneously extended assistance to his subjects, displaying energy and fair-mindedness, hoping that by the light of justice he might make Iran the envy of East and West, and set that fine fervor which characterized the first great epochs of Persia, to flowing again through the veins of her people. As is clear to the discerning, the writer has for this reason felt it necessary to put down for the sake of God alone, and as a tribute to this high endeavor, a brief statement on certain urgent questions. To demonstrate that his one purpose is to promote the general welfare, he has withheld his name, since he believes that guidance toward righteousness is in itself a righteous act. He offers these few words of counsel to his country's sons, words spoken for God's sake alone and in the spirit of a faithful friend. Our Lord, who knows all things, bears witness that this servant seeks nothing but what is right and good, for he, a wanderer in the desert of God's love, has come into a realm where the hand of denial or assent, of praise or blame, can touch him not. We nourish your souls for the sake of God. We seek from you neither recompense nor thanks. The hand is veiled, yet the pen writes as bidden. The horse leaps forward, yet the rider's hidden. O people of Persia, look into those blossoming pages that tell of another day, a time long past. Read them in wonder, see the great sight. Iran in that day was as the heart of the world. She was the bright torch flaming in the assemblage of mankind. Her power and glory shone out like the morning above the world's horizon, and the splendor of her learning cast its rays over east and west. Word of the widespread empire of those who wore her crown reached even to the dwellers in the Arctic circle, and the fame of the awesome presence of her King of Kings humbled the rulers of Greece and Rome. The greatest of the world's philosophers marveled at the wisdom of her government, and her political system became the model for all the kings of the four continents then known. She was distinguished among all peoples for the scope of her dominion. She was honored by all for her praiseworthy culture and civilization. She was as the pivot of the world. She was the source and center of sciences and arts, the wellspring of great inventions and discoveries, the rich mine of human virtues and perfection. The intellect, the wisdom of the individual members of this excellent nation dazzled the minds of other peoples. The brilliance and perceptive genius that characterized all this noble race aroused the envy of the whole world. Aside from that which is a matter of record in Persian histories, it is stated in the Old Testament, established today among all European peoples as a sacred and canonical text, that in the time of Cyrus, called in Iranian works Bahman, son of Isfandiar, the 360 divisions of the Persian Empire extended from the inner confines of India and China to the farthermost reaches of Yemen and Ethiopia. The Greek accounts as well relate how this proud sovereign came against them with an innumerable host and left their own till then victorious dominion level with the dust. He made the pillars of all the governments to quake. According to that authoritative Arab work, the history of Abulfida, he took over the entire known world. It is likewise recorded in this same text and elsewhere that Fereydun, a king of the Pishtadian dynasty, who was indeed, for his inherent perfections, his powers of judgment, the scope of his knowledge, and his long series of continual victories, unique among all the rulers who preceded and followed him, divided the whole known world among his three sons. As attested by the annals of the world's most illustrious peoples, the first government to be established on earth, the foremost empire to be organized among the nations, was Persia's throne and diadem. O people of Persia, awake from your drunken sleep. Rise up from your lethargy, be fair in your judgment. Will the dictates of honor permit this holy land, once the wellspring of world civilization, the source of glory and joy for all mankind, the envy of East and West, to remain an object of pity, deplored by all nations? She was once the noblest of peoples. Will you let contemporary history register for the ages her now degenerate state? Will you complacently accept her present wretchedness when she was once the land of all mankind's desire? Must she now, for this contemptible sloth, this failure to struggle, this utter ignorance, be accounted the most backward of nations? Were not the people of Persia in days long gone the head and front of intellect and wisdom? Did they not, by God's grace, shine out like the day star from the horizons of divine knowledge? How is it that we are satisfied today with this miserable condition, are engrossed in our licentious passions, have blinded ourselves to supreme happiness, to that which is pleasing in God's sight, and have all become absorbed in our selfish concerns and the search for ignoble personal advantage? This fairest of lands was once a lamp streaming with the rays of divine knowledge, of science and art, of nobility and high achievement, of wisdom and valor. Today, because of the idleness and lethargy of her people, their torpor, their undisciplined way of life, their lack of pride, lack of ambition, her bright fortune has been totally eclipsed. Her light has turned to darkness. The seven heavens and the seven earths weep over the mighty when he is brought low. It should not be imagined that the people of Persia are inherently deficient in intelligence, or that for essential perceptiveness and understanding, inborn sagacity, intuition and wisdom, or innate capacity, they are inferior to others. God forbid. On the contrary, they have always excelled all other peoples in endowments conferred by birth. Persia herself, moreover, from the standpoint of her temperate climate and natural beauties, her geographical advantages and her rich soil, is blessed to a supreme degree. What she urgently requires, however, is deep reflection, resolute action, training, inspiration, and encouragement. Her people must make a massive effort, and their pride must be aroused. Today, throughout the five continents of the globe, it is Europe and most sections of America that are renowned for law and order, government and commerce, art and industry, science, philosophy, and education. Yet in ancient times, these were the most savage of the world's peoples, the most ignorant and brutish. They were even stigmatized as barbarians, that is, utterly rude and uncivilized. Further, from the 5th century after Christ until the 15th, that period defined as the Middle Ages, such terrible struggles and fierce upheavals, such ruthless encounters and horrifying acts were the rule among the peoples of Europe, that the Europeans rightly described those 10 centuries as the Dark Ages. The basis of Europe's progress and civilization was actually laid in the 15th century of the Christian era, and from that time on, all her present evident culture has been under the stimulus of great minds and as a result of the expansion of the frontiers of knowledge and the exertion of energetic and ambitious efforts in the process of development. Today, by the grace of God and the spiritual influence of his universal manifestation, the fair-minded ruler of Iran has gathered his people into the shelter of justice, and the sincerity of the imperial purpose has shown itself in kingly acts. Hoping that his reign will rival the glorious past, he has sought to establish equity and righteousness and to foster education in the processes of civilization throughout this noble land, and to translate from potentiality into actuality whatever will ensure its progress. Not until now had we seen a monarch holding in his capable hands the reins of affairs, and on whose high resolve the welfare of all his subjects depends, exerting as it would befit him, like a benevolent father, his efforts toward the training and cultivation of his people, seeking to ensure their well-being and peace of mind, and exhibiting due concern for their interests. This servant and those like him have therefore remained silent. Now, however, it is clear to the discerning that the Shah has of his own accord determined to establish a just government and to secure the progress of all his subjects. His honorable intention has consequently evoked this present statement. It is indeed strange that instead of offering thanks for this bounty, which truly derives from the grace of Almighty God, by arising as one in gratitude and enthusiasm and praying that these noble purposes will daily multiply. Some, on the contrary, whose reason has been corrupted by personal motives and the clarity of whose perception has been clouded by self-interest and conceit, whose energies are devoted to the service of their passions, whose sense of pride is perverted to the love of leadership, have raised the standard of opposition and waxed loud in their complaints. Up to now, they blamed the Shah for not, on his own initiative, working for his people's welfare and seeking to bring about their peace and well-being. Now that he has inaugurated this great design, they have changed their tune. Some say that these are newfangled methods and foreign isms, quite unrelated to the present needs and the time-honored customs of Persia. Others have rallied the helpless masses who know nothing of religion or its laws and basic principles and therefore have no power of discrimination, and tell them that these modern methods are the practices of heathen peoples and are contrary to the venerated canons of true faith, and they add the saying, "He who imitates a people is one of them." One group insists that such reforms should go forward with great deliberation, step by step, haste being inadmissible. Another maintains that only such measures should be adopted as the Persians themselves devise, that they themselves should reform their political administration and their educational system and the state of their culture, and that there is no need to borrow improvements from other nations. Every faction, in short, follows its own particular illusion. O people of Persia, how long will you wander? How long must your confusion last? How long will it go on, this conflict of opinions, this useless antagonism, this ignorance, this refusal to think? Others are alert, and we sleep our dreamless sleep. Other nations are making every effort to improve their condition. We are trapped in our desires and self-indulgences, and at every step we stumble into a new snare. God is our witness that we have no ulterior motive in developing this theme. We seek neither to curry favor with anyone, nor to attract anyone to ourselves, nor to derive any material benefit therefrom. We speak only as one earnestly desiring the good pleasure of God, for we have turned our gaze away from the world and its peoples, and have sought refuge in the sheltering care of the Lord. No pay do I ask of you for this. My reward is of God alone. Those who maintain that these modern concepts apply only to other countries and are irrelevant to Iran, that they do not satisfy her requirements or suit her way of life, disregard the fact that other nations were once as we are now. Did not these new systems and procedures, these progressive enterprises, contribute to the advancement of those countries? Were the people of Europe harmed by the adoption of such measures, or did they rather, by these means, reach the highest degree of material development? Is it not true that for centuries the people of Persia have lived as we see them living today, carrying out the pattern of the past? Have any discernible benefits resulted? Has any progress been made? If these things had not been tested by experience, some in whose minds the light of native intelligence is clouded might idly question them. On the contrary, however, every aspect of these prerequisites to progress have in other countries been time and again put to the test, and their benefits demonstrated so plainly that even the dullest mind can grasp them. Let us consider this justly and without bias. Let us ask ourselves which one of these basic principles and sound, well-established procedures would fail to satisfy our present needs, or would be incompatible with Persia's best political interests, or injurious to the general welfare of her people. Would the extension of education, the development of useful arts and sciences, the promotion of industry and technology be harmful things? For such endeavor lifts the individual within the mass and raises him out of the depths of ignorance to the highest reaches of knowledge and human excellence. Would the setting up of just legislation in accord with the divine laws which guarantee the happiness of society and protect the rights of all mankind and are an impregnable proof against assault, would such laws ensuring the integrity of the members of society and their equality before the law inhibit their prosperity and success? Or if by using one's perceptive faculties One can draw analogies from present circumstances and the conclusions arrived at by collective experience, and can envisage as coming realities situations now only potential. Would it be unreasonable to take such present measures as would guarantee our future security? Would it seem short-sighted, improvident, and unsound? Would it constitute a deviation from what is right and proper if we were to strengthen our relationships with neighboring countries, enter into binding treaties with the great powers, foster friendly connections with well-disposed governments, look to the expansion of trade with the nations of East and West, develop our natural resources, and increase the wealth of our people? Would it spell perdition for our subjects if the provincial and district governors were relieved of their present absolute authority, whereby they function exactly as they please, and were instead limited to equity and truth? And if their sentences involving capital punishment, imprisonment, and the like were contingent on confirmation by the Shah and by higher courts in the capital, who would first duly investigate the case and determine the nature and seriousness of the crime, and then hand down a just decision subject to the issuance of a decree by the sovereign? If bribery and corruption, known today by the pleasant names of gifts and favors, were forever excluded, would this threaten the foundations of justice? Would it be an evidence of unsound thinking to deliver the soldiery, who are a living sacrifice to the state and the people and brave death at every turn, from their present extreme misery and indigence, and to make adequate arrangements for their sustenance, clothing, and housing, and exert every effort to instruct their officers in military science and supply them with the most advanced types of firearms and other weapons? Should anyone object that the above-mentioned reforms have never yet been fully effected, he should consider the matter impartially and know that these deficiencies have resulted from the total absence of a unified public opinion and the lack of zeal and resolve and devotion in the country's leaders. It is obvious that not until the people are educated, not until public opinion is rightly focused, not until government officials, even minor ones, are free from even the least remnant of corruption, can the country be properly administered. Not until discipline, order, and good government reach the degree where an individual, even if he should put forth his utmost efforts to do so, would still find himself unable to deviate by so much as a hair's breadth from righteousness, can the desired reforms be regarded as fully established. Furthermore, any agency whatever, though it be the instrument of mankind's greatest good, is capable of misuse. Its proper use or abuse depends on the varying degrees of enlightenment, capacity, faith, honesty, devotion, and high-mindedness of the leaders of public opinion. The Shah has certainly done his part, and the execution of the proposed beneficial measures is now in the hands of persons functioning in assemblies of consultation. If these individuals prove to be pure and high-minded, if they remain free from the taint of corruption, the confirmations of God will make them a never-failing source of bounty to mankind. He will cause to issue from their lips and their pens what will bless the people, so that every corner of this noble country of Iran will be illumined with their justice and integrity, and the rays of that light will encompass the whole earth. Neither will this be difficult with God. Otherwise, it is clear that the results will prove unacceptable, for it has been directly witnessed in certain foreign countries that following on the establishment of parliaments, those bodies actually distressed and confused the people, and their well-meant reforms produced maleficent results. While the setting up of parliaments, the organizing of assemblies of consultation, constitutes the very foundation and bedrock of government, there are several essential requirements which these institutions must fulfill. First, the elected members must be righteous, God-fearing, high-minded, incorruptible. Second, they must be fully cognizant in every particular of the laws of God, informed as to the highest principles of law, first in the rules which govern the management of internal affairs and the conduct of foreign relations, skilled in the useful arts of civilization and content with their lawful emoluments. Let it not be imagined that members of this type would be impossible to find. Through the grace of God and His chosen ones and the high endeavors of the devoted and the consecrated, every difficulty can be easily resolved. Every problem, however complex, will prove simpler than blinking an eye. If, however, the members of these consultative assemblies are inferior, ignorant, uninformed of the laws of government and administration, unwise, of low aim, indifferent, idle, self-seeking, no benefit will accrue from the organizing of such bodies. Where in the past, if a poor man wanted his rights, he had only to offer a gift to one individual, now he would either have to renounce all hope of justice or else satisfy the entire membership. Close investigation will show that the primary cause of oppression and injustice, of unrighteousness, irregularity, and disorder, is the people's lack of religious faith and the fact that they are uneducated. When, for example, the people are genuinely religious and are literate and well-schooled, and a difficulty presents itself, they can apply to the local authorities. If they do not meet with justice and secure their rights, and if they see that the conduct of the local government is incompatible with the divine good pleasure and the king's justice, they can then take their case to higher courts and describe the deviation of the local administration from the spiritual law. Those courts can then send for the local records of the case, and in this way justice will be done. At present, however, because of their inadequate schooling, most of the population lack even the vocabulary to explain what they want. As to those persons who, here and there, are considered leaders of the people, because this is only the beginning of the new administrative process, they are not yet sufficiently advanced in their education to have experienced the delights of dispensing justice, or to have tasted the exhilaration of promoting righteousness, or to have drunk from the springs of a clear conscience and a sincere intent. They have not properly understood that man's supreme honor and real happiness lie in self-respect, in high resolves and noble purposes, in integrity and moral quality, in immaculacy of mind. They have rather imagined that their greatness consists in the accumulation, by whatever means may offer, of worldly goods. A man should pause and reflect and be just. His Lord, out of measureless grace, has made him a human being and honored him with the words, "Verily we created man in the goodliest of forms," and caused his mercy which rises out of the dawn of oneness to shine down upon him until he became the wellspring of the words of God and the place where the mysteries of heaven alighted. And on the morning of creation he was covered with the rays of the qualities of perfection and the graces of holiness. How can he stain this immaculate garment with the filth of selfish desires, or exchange this everlasting honor for infamy? Dost thou think thyself only a puny form when the universe is folded up within thee? Were it not our purpose to be brief and to develop our primary subject, we would here set down a summary of themes from the divine world as to the reality of man and his high station and the surpassing value and worth of the human race. Let this be for another time. The highest station, the supreme sphere, the noblest, most sublime position in creation, whether visible or invisible, whether Alpha or Omega, is that of the prophets of God, notwithstanding the fact that for the most part they have to outward seeming been possessed of nothing but their own poverty. In the same way, ineffable glory is set apart for the holy ones and those who are nearest to the threshold of God, although such as these have never for a moment concerned themselves with material gain. Then comes the station of those just kings whose fame as protectors of the people and dispensers of divine justice has filled the world, whose name as powerful champions of the people's rights has echoed through creation. These give no thought to amassing enormous fortunes for themselves. They believe, rather, that their own wealth lies in enriching their subjects. To them, if every individual citizen has affluence and ease, the royal coffers are full. They take no pride in gold and silver, but rather in their enlightenment and their determination to achieve the universal good. Next in rank are those eminent and honorable ministers of state and representatives who place the will of God above their own, and whose administrative skill and wisdom in the conduct of their office raises the science of government to new heights of perfection. They shine in the learned world like lamps of knowledge. Their thinking, their attitudes, and their acts demonstrate their patriotism and their concern for the country's advancement. Content with a modest stipend, they consecrate their days and nights to the execution of important duties and the devising of methods to ensure the progress of the people. Through the effectiveness of their wise counsel, the soundness of their judgment, they have ever caused their governments to become an example to be followed by all the governments of the world. They have made their capital city a focal center of great world undertakings. They have won distinction, attaining a supreme degree of personal eminence and reaching the loftiest heights of repute and character.
This is the end of side one, ending on page 21. Please turn the cassette.